KPOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of Maggots and Men, Sunday, January 15th at 4:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Maggots and Men is an experimental film set in post-revolutionary Russia, and it tells the story of the 1921 uprising of the Kronstadt sailors with a subtext of gender anarchy. This film is a benefit for Out There Adventures, whose mission is to cultivate leadership and build community for queer youth through adventure. Again, that's Maggots and Men, Sunday, January 15th, 4:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO here in Portland, where the time is now 9 o'clock, and time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer is Patsy Kullberg. The mole is the beast that works underground to both expose and undermine the entrenched power structures that lie behind and below the surface of our commodified world. At the core of this world is the social arrangement we call capitalism, which gives the control of labor and the products of labor to the small and very wealthy elite who are permitted to own the wealth we all produce and to manage it in their own interests. The history of this system over recent years has now led us to the prospect of 4 years of governance by a president and a party with a record of utter disregard for the well-being of most of us and eager to turn over even more of our world to private ownership. We live in times when we must not only resist what the Trump administration will try to do, we need to collaborate in creating a vision of a world in which the wealth of our world is dedicated to sustain and enhance the lives of all of us. On today's Old Mole, we will continue, we will contribute to this creative work. Kerry Cantrell and Bill Resnick will talk about how the recognition and organization of intersex people contributes to a society based on mutuality instead of exploitation. Joe Clement will share a piece about how a universal basic income could free us from wage slavery, that is, from the need to organize our working lives around the interests of capital. The Old Mole's Jan Hocken will talk with Bob Samuels about the need for a new model of global justice and government that gets us beyond narcissistic nationalism and the capitalist death drive. And I will close the show with a vision of a post-capitalist world and how we might get there. If you miss any part of today's show or want to share it with others, it will be available on the KBOO website, that's kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can also find additional information about guests and topics. Well, last week, Bill Resnick and Kerry Cantrell talked about Kerry's experience from birth as an intersex person, how after being deceived for many years and undergoing a lot of pain, she discovered the truth about herself and found commitment and peace in social activism. Today, they will talk about how intersex action and work by other sexual minorities changes not only popular ideas about sexual morality, but can help to build a society based on mutuality instead of exploitation.
Hi, Kerry Cantrell. Welcome back.
Thank you, Bill.
KBOO.
Thank you.
We've talked before about your experience in life, which was characteristic of millions of people and intersex people. And other sexual minorities who also lived a life of shame and hiding and confusion. People are organizing. You are now the coordinator organizer, NWIAL, the Northwest Intersex Action League. You're organizing people, basically,
yeah.
And there's a national organization. We're going to talk today about why you're organizing, what your goals are, But also, I think we want to talk about today in the second half of this interview, the tremendous significance of sexuality and sexual morality and rules and discipline in creating authority structures and class structures and really subordinating and forcing people into shame and a sense of deficiency, which really is one of the underlying strengths of hierarchical authority structures, is making people feel deficient.
Especially consumerist hierarchical authority structures, like the one we exist under.
Yes, and also it makes a lot of money for some people.
They make you think you're deficient at something, they can always convince you to buy something.
Yes, that's...
Maybe surgeries, maybe medicines, maybe they just want you to buy some makeup or some clothes that reinforce
of course,
your gender identity.
In fact, look normal and attractive and be able to get a job.
If
you don't present as sort of normal, then employers just won't take you. And so it's life itself requires all of this hiding and shame. And it gives power to the people over you. So, Carrot, let's talk about the NWIO. You're organizing people. Why and for what?
Why and for what reason? Oh, goodness. All right. So the Northwest Intersex Action League. The Northwest Intersex Action League was basically born out of a social justice project that I began working on immediately after meeting a conference of intersex people. That was a... Summer of 2015, I attended a national support group conference for androgen insensitivity and different sex development support group. And that, it sort of changed my life. Touching community, reflecting my experiences with people who had been through a similar journey, really, really, really changed my life.
It must have been just an epiphany, powerful service.
Absolutely. As far as consciousness and awareness of my body and my experience, I always knew something was wrong. You know, I covered my experience, manifested a lot of addictions and a lot of escapist attitudes and behaviors because I was always constantly trying to run from some pain. I had no language to describe who I was or what I had gone through. So I did the best I could with substances and travel and all sorts of stuff. But I finally, just like when you pull a thread from a sweater, the whole sweater becomes unraveled. And eventually it just got to be a breaking point. I had a summer off 1 year, 2 years ago in 2015, and went to support group. It handed me language to describe myself. It handed me community members who could be there for me and support my experiences because they had gone through the same thing. It handed me emotional support for people who had showed up to that community as allies and were ready and willing to take on a heavier caseload as allies and help us out. And not only that, but it handed me a community of people who just gave me strength every single day. So it changed my life. It changed my life, and I wanted to be able to empower other people close to me, wherever I was, in the exact same way. So that's the birth of the Northwest Intersex Action League. And we're here in Portland, and so it takes on a very Portland flavor. We want to stress diversity as much as possible. We want to stress inclusion as much as possible. Unfortunately, the intersex movement in this country so far has been coming from a very heteronormative, a white perspective, people who have access to a tiered insurance system, a healthcare system, people who have access to time off in order to attend conferences are mainly the benefits and recipients of this movement so far.
There are many intersex people who just don't want to be identified as different, who have made lives fairly successfully, I suspect, in bourgeois society. Mm. As you pointed out, they tell people lies saying they had an early infection or they had a hormonal problem and they had all the surgery and they can present mostly as female.
Well, there are some folks like that. And, you know, honestly, I was like that. And I was 26 years old before I came out as an intersex person, and I spun that narrative quite frequently. I was a female. I had a reproductive disorder. I told my sexual partners that I had this problem and that problem and that I was defective. And I did my best to protect that ego, to protect that image which had been sold to me.
Forced upon you.
Forced upon me. Well, I basically had been purchased into that system through insurance, through my parents' decisions, my doctor's decisions, and the profits they made and all that stuff. I basically had been purchased as a human body. Just like materials are purchased in a factory and manufactured, you get a label stuck on you right when you're all done being manufactured, and then off you go out into society. And that's kind of what happened to me too. But touching an intersex community changed my life. It handed me new language. It was about this time I began identifying not as female anymore, but as an intersex person. That's the truth of my experience. I'm an intersex person. I was not born female. I don't even have XX chromosomes. I was not born with a fully developed vagina. I wasn't born with any ovaries. I wasn't born with the capability to develop and create life. So I think the typical definitions of female don't apply to me. And I started thinking about that over the next 2 years. And my experiences with the Northwest Intersex Action League, getting that off the ground, creating allies with different communities here in Portland, really showed me what kind of diversity are in Portland. Thank you so much, Portland, for showing me what kind of diversity this humanity has to offer. With that realization and the realization of my own truth as an intersex person, I've come to the conclusion that gender is 100% made up. Every human being deserves rights and respect based on their body and who they are at birth. And as far as gender expression, I think it's superficial at best we can describe gender, because it's something that you can apply and take off. It's something that you can manipulate extremely easily with makeup and clothes and surgeries and chemicals, or it's something that you can sort of detransition from as well.
Yeah, and you can also shape your own emotionality to fit your gender and to be able to fit in and, in fact, lead a successful emotional life, actually, yeah, after you've shaped yourself. People do shape themselves.
Absolutely.
Especially in adolescence. Uh-huh. They take on characteristics and then they feel as if they were born that way. In fact, my sense is that a lot of it is sort of luck, and the relationships we have, the way we think and feel, the people we talk to, and we create a sort of sexual emotional being.
Absolutely.
Out of ourselves. And
I think it really comes down to context. I mentioned in the last interview we did my experience with hormonal interventions. And this is a great analogy for the whole transition and gender identification process as well. When it's forced on you, it's a completely different experience. You know what I mean? And when it's something that you, as you just mentioned, are able to self-determine and able to express freely and have that identity supported, it's a completely different experience. Who can say, except for you, whether or not that's the truest, most authentic manifestation of what you are, who you are? But that's all it is. That's all everybody wants, is to be unconditionally accepted. And so I think it's a wonderful thing to see as much expression as we do these days, and as much transition as we do as well, and fluctuation between expressions. And our culture is becoming stronger and more elastic at accepting unconditionally people's expressions. And that's kind of worrisome for people who want to make money off of rigid expressions of humanity. And so you see policies that really try and inhibit the movements and expressions of transgendered folk, of intersex people, of really, as you mentioned, any other minority that threatens a heteronormative white power base.
I'm talking to Carrie Cantrell. We're talking about intersex people and organizing. And Carrie is the mother, in some ways, founder of the Northwest Intersex Action League. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of people who are coming to Carrie and the league and around the country in similar sorts of organizations and the national organization to not just challenge the suppression of intersexuality and the vicious, horrible things that have been done to people over centuries, but to also to shape a sort of new morality and work with other sexual minorities and, in fact, social justice groups in
Absolutely.
General to change things. It seems to me, Carrie, that what you're doing is really constructing a new morality of sexuality. It's true that, I mean, as you pointed out, we now should have to honor people's expressions and and how they express. But there's some things we don't honor, which is dishonesty. I mean, there's a morality of sexuality developing out of this challenge to this primitive sexual morality that's so constricting. Only in marriage, for example. That
right.
was a ridiculous one. And sexuality is so constrained. Only some positions. No oral sex, of course.
Right.
I mean, all of this stuff into the 20th century, the
right.
late 20th century, it was punishable by law.
Oh, yeah.
They would go into bedrooms and put people in jail for having sexuality that was somewhat different. And those cases were notorious. And they were covered in the press. And people were actually influenced by all that primitive stuff.
It is very primitive, actually. You look at where these moralities came from, and I'll preface this next statement with, I grew up on farms in the country in rural settings in North Carolina. And you look at these primitive constructions of morality and you wonder, what are they here for? And you start making analogies and you see that these moralities, these rules that society creates and enforces through various means like social stigmatization, jailing, shaming, et cetera, social bullying, basically. You see that they're reinforced the same way that fence walls are reinforced on farms, right? You look at the human didactic system, males and females are as the binary. This is a constructed world that we've been placed in because of the social conditioning we've all experienced as a collective, a human collective. And you see that for whatever reason, thousands of years ago, somebody thought it was their purview and their entitlement to make sure that people were reproducing. We've all read the Bible. We've all heard about conservative views on procreation. And as you just mentioned, there's this incredibly moral-based sort of objection to people having sex for pleasure. It's meant to be only reproductive. And so that's why you come up with all these rules. And it's about subjugating people for the sake of reproduction. To me, that makes me feel like I'm a farmed animal. And that's ridiculous. That's oppressive for everybody when human beings are treated like farm animals.
But there's another morality that's emerging, it seems to me, out of Absolutely. Your organization and many others. It's not as if every expression is good. I mean, there's a lot of people who do horrible things with sexuals. The motive is partly sexual. It's partly power. It's partly conquest. In any event, there is a sexual morality developing. What is the morality that we want to encourage people to be sort of wildly and really expressive sexually, but we have responsibilities to others. We have other values.
Right.
And sexuality is, in fact, much better when we recognize those other values.
Certainly.
But tell us about that story.
I'm a feminist when it comes down to it. Absolutely, 100%. And that's where most of my ideologies are based out of. So I view this new sexual morality being formed. You can see it expressed in trans movement, LGBTQ movement. You can see it expressed in the intersex movement. And then making analogies outside of the sexual minority community. There's also movements for other marginalized communities to just simply resist and become empowered and free and obtain equal rights. Because that's everybody's right, is to express themselves freely. And what you just said, there are definitely violent manifestations of freedom, quote unquote. Some people might want to call it chaos or violence or something like that. As far as person-to-person accountability, we all should be empowering and standing in solidarity with each other.
And honest with one
and
another.
And honesty. Exactly.
And communicating with one another. And seeking pleasures for not just ourselves, some kind of selfish sexuality, but where, in fact, we create a sexuality where we're mutual.
Yes, mutual. We want to create a society that's mutualistic and not exchange-based. We've all been oppressed. Women, minorities, sexual minorities, immigrants, we've all been oppressed by a system which is designed for a bottom line production and profit. We're the farm animals, and we're meant to be producing some sort of profit for somebody somewhere in some way or another, whether you're black, brown, native, woman, man, intersex person, trans, queer, you're meant to be producing something for someone somewhere, and if you're not, then you're useless in society.
Right, and labor.
And labor, exactly.
Obedient labor is very, very important
obedient
in a society to the elites.
Absolutely.
They want obedience. They hire high priests to tell people how to be obedient.
Hallelujah.
In every sphere. You know, it sounds like a sort of a crude Marxism, and I will accept the Marxism part. It's not crude at all. Those, in fact, larger factors really do ultimately motivate and shape all of those oppressive cultural forms have developed by the need for obedience and to be farm animals. But people are breaking out of that.
We arrive back to the intersex people. And intersex people biologically are shaped pretty much not to reproduce. It's very rare to find intersex people that can have children naturally, especially because you need extreme like virility and fertility, even in the best cases if you are born on a didactic level. But if you're born with a fully functioning reproductive system, there's even complications that can transpire. So intersex people don't really have capabilities for reproducing the same way that didactic people do. That's where the institutionalized system has a problem with intersex people. We don't conform naturally. We're born nonconformist to this system. And so in order to hide the proof that their system is flawed, they hide intersex people. That's how it's worked historically. In order to hide the proof that Black people are oppressed, they put Black people in jail and they hide them. In order to hide the proof that Native people are being oppressed, they don't cover it and they simply do what they need to do. Same thing with every other minority on the planet. As soon as a rabble gets roused and the foundation gets shaky, they're a house of cards. Something is done to oppress. So whether it's stigmatization and oppression through surgery or incarceration or simply just straight up subjugation through genocide, as Native Americans experience, someone's going to try and squeeze profit from you.
That may be changing. It may actually also get worse, but I surely hope not. There are real challenges to it. There's one thing that we haven't covered. What in society, however, is done is outreach to all of those people and enlightening them, like your organization is doing for your set. There are other ways of doing it, like stopping bullying in schools, forcing police to stop their attack. They used to just beat up nonconforming people. Now there are cameras that when they show them, they still are beating up and killing some people. Mm-hmm. There are so many ways, in fact, which we can enforce,
empower
one another, and also at the workplace. And then there are things that have to be done so that particularly white males in this society have a decent role and can get jobs and can live reasonable lives. So many of them, in fact, are also being shut out of the possibility of a dignified life. That's a whole nother story that we have to talk about.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, we can't talk about all the things. But it seems to me that your organization and many other organizations are moving to unite around these larger goals.
For me, it all comes down to empowerment and unconditional support and love. It comes full circle now. My activism is spiritual on that level. It is 100% meant to uplift and support people that I come in contact with. That's why I wanted to create the Northwest Intersex Action League. I made it sound like a band of superheroes for a reason. I want every single intersex person who finds us to feel like a superhero when they come out of the closet and make contact with another person.
And with other superheroes and cooperating, a cooperative.
Yes, exactly.
And democratic.
Action
every
League
super
Unite.
Mayor may have different ideas on things. And you can't just use your super strength to batter them in one another. Thanks so much for talking to us today, Carrie Cantrell.
The pleasure is all mine, Bill.
That's Half Jack by the Dresden Dolls with the lyrics, "It's half biology and half corrective surgery gone wrong. You'll notice something funny if you hang around here for too long in some black hole before they had these magic pills to take it back. I'm half Jill and half Jack." Here on the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO, I'm Clayton Morgridge. Well, 2 weeks ago on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick and his guest had a brief but important disagreement about the viability of a universal basic income. Here to make the case for providing everyone with enough to live on independently of their labor is Joe Clement.
A couple weeks ago on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Bill Resnick brought on David Reamer to talk about reduction programs. When the topic of a universal basic income came up, though, it turned into an ideologically pitched discussion about the moral hazard of removing the economic compulsion to work. To carry on the conversation about the significance of work and thinking through the consequences of something like a universal basic income removing the economic compulsion to work, I'm going to read from Peter Frase's blog post, "Do They Owe Us a Living?"
Frase begins by criticizing socialist economists Jason Shulman and David Schweikert for trying to predict exactly what socialism will look like. Frase contends that this would be, quote, foolhardy and moreover anti-democratic, since it preempts the actions and decisions of the actual masses who will have to make a post-capitalist world happen. So while these thought experiments about alternative economic models can be useful in clarifying our principles, I don't think we need to take the details all that seriously. Rather than trying to draw up a detailed blueprint of a socialist economy, I prefer to think in terms of what Andre Gorz called non-reformist reforms, changes to the system that can be implemented under capitalism, but which sets the stage for much further radical transformations. And I want to highlight one particular such reform that's associated with Gorz called the universal basic income. Frase finds the universal basic income compelling because it, quote, directly addresses one of the most fundamental objectionable things about capitalism, namely the fact that almost everyone is dependent on performing wage labor in order to survive. What's so objectionable for Frase is that, quote, we live in a society that is more physically productive than any other that has ever existed. 80 years ago, John Maynard Keynes was predicting that the greatest problem his grandchildren would face was what to do with their abundant leisure time. Instead, we're all working more than ever. Frase points out that a UBI would give people the option of opting out of the labor market and effectively reduce the amount of unpleasant work people have to do, a concern that baffles him when it's missing from a planned socialist economy. This brings Frase to one of the things he found most unappealing about David Schweikert's vision. Quote, his description of economic life seems to assume that the ideal way to live is to have some job that you go off to for 40 hours a week for the rest of your life. If labor is unpleasant, the solution is to give workers more control rather than giving them an option to opt out of work, voice rather than exit, to use Albert Hirschman's lovely phrase. Now, maybe this makes sense to some people who grew up in the mid-20th century when the labor market was less volatile and careers were more stable, but it doesn't make any sense to me. Even if jobs for all is possible, why would it be desirable? If there's not enough work to go around, why would you go and create more? And maybe it's true that if we make the workplace democratic, then work will be fulfilling and people won't mind it. But in that case, why force them? It's at this point that you're supposed to start talking about material incentives, to take Schweikert's choice of jargon. It usually starts with some troll objecting that socialism is impossible because nobody will do any work without the fear of starvation. Then the socialist comes back with some argument about how socialism is actually going to motivate everyone to go out there and work hard. For Schweikert's system, the answer is that, quote, one's income is directly tied to the success of one's firm, end quote. And so you work hard for the material reward. But approaching the problem this way gets the whole issue backwards by proposing solutions before we have understood what the actual problem is. If you just talk in general terms about giving people incentives to work, you're neglecting the reality that while some work would have to be done in any kind of desirable society, other kinds of work should actually be disincentivized. Broadly speaking, I'd say that paid work in capitalism falls into at least the following four categories. 1. Things that people want done, but which nobody particularly wants to do. 2. Things that people would do voluntarily provided they have enough time, even if they weren't paid. 3. Things that are useless or destructive and happen only because they facilitate capital accumulation and people's need for jobs. And 4. Things that people may want done and or may want to do, but which have destructive effects on other people or the environment. The discussions about material incentives are relevant to things in Category 1, but much of labor in modern capitalist societies falls into the other categories. I'd argue that a lot of artistic and knowledge work falls into Category 2, so does childcare, although just who does it voluntarily is another matter, which is why feminism is still a core part of socialist analysis. Financial engineering, telemarketing, and basically anything that happens in a private health insurance company falls into Category 3, and so does much of the estimated 25% of U.S. employment taken up by what economists call guard labor, which includes stuff like supervising workers, running the industrial prison complex, and providing private security, or just other stuff that's mostly about preserving current power relations and maintaining inequality rather than doing anything useful. And driving a car or burning coal for electricity might fall in Category 4. And even though I can sketch out examples like this, in general it's pretty hard to differentiate these different kinds of labor in capitalism. That's because capitalism creates a situation where all work is quote-unquote good, because it provides jobs, which people need in order to survive. However, these different kinds of labor wouldn't get differentiated in Schweikert's vision of market socialism either, since he still assumes that everyone is forced to work. Moreover, the idea of government as employer last resort implies that we'd be creating more useless Category 3 work for people. And some, Frase points out, advocate an alternative planning system that differentiates ahead of time between desirable and undesirable work. But such totalitarian planning isn't necessary, Frase argues, and makes things more bureaucratic than they need to be. We should start instead with making people less dependent on wage labor. Social services like public education and universal health care go part of the way, but to strike at the root of wage slavery, you need something like a universal basic income. And Frase anticipates the resistance, quote, with the critics screaming, "But nobody would do any work." At one level, I think this is just silly. For one thing, at least in the short run, most people would want to make more than the guaranteed minimum, and so would continue to work. For another thing, it's clear that people do various jobs for a lot of different reasons that have nothing to do with money, and some kinds of work would get more popular if people didn't have to worry about having the money to meet their basic needs. Some jobs are really enjoyable, in other words, and people would do them for free if they could. Other kinds of work give the returns by conferring some kind of status. For example, for all but the most famous artists, making art is more about gaining recognition than making money. One appealing aspect of a basic income is that it would start to sort out the distinctions between the different kinds of labor I outlined above. If some jobs start being things people do as hobbies, then great. If some jobs disappear and we don't miss them, then great. And if you have to pay people more to make them take crappy jobs, that's great. However, in a world with a guaranteed income, it could very well turn out that there are some things that just aren't getting done. It's not clear that you'd be able to find enough people to clean office bathrooms or work the night shift at 7-Eleven if they had access to a basic income, no matter what you paid them. Some people invoke the above scenario as an argument against basic income, but let me emphasize, this is a problem I would love to have. Once it becomes clear what kind of work is both desired and undersupplied, we can have a proper political struggle about how that work will get done. Will it be by offering special rewards like Schweikert's material incentives? Or will it be by creating some national service requirement in exchange for the basic income? Say, you have to go clean toilets or work the night shift at 7-Eleven once a month. Or will it be by finding clever new ways to automate these jobs, or by deciding that we can really do without some of these things we thought we needed? I can't predict in advance what the solution will be, and I don't have to. That's really the most important point I want to make here. I think the lesson of history is that momentous social change never happens because someone came up with a detailed plan for the future, won people over to it, and then implemented it. The chaos of real people making their own history always overwhelms such neat plans.
For the Old Mole Variety Hour, I'm Joe Clement. I've been reading from Peter Frase's blog about what a universal basic income might actually do to our work ethic and how we spend our time.
Thanks, Joe, and Peter Frase. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Well, writer and educator Bob Samuels has a new book out called Psychoanalyzing the Left and Right After Donald Trump, Conservatism, Liberalism, and Neoliberal Populisms. He's on the phone now to talk with the Old Mole's Jan Hocken. Jan.
Bob Samuels, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Sadly enough, your book, Psychoanalyzing the Left and Right After Donald Trump, is more timely than ever and should enjoy at least a four-year shelf life before being remaindered. But we've got a long way to go. Now, many commentators, including those of us on our program, have analyzed the forces in play that produced Trump's candidacy. You are less a prognosticator than analyst of both the left and the right and some of the dynamics driving the election and larger political forces that we're confronting now in the world. So let's first talk about your use of psychoanalysis and what you think psychoanalysis brings to understanding not the dynamics, the personality dynamics of candidates, but the social dynamics that are important to take into account in assessing what some have determined to be very non-rational identifications with politicians who do not reflect their actual material interests.
So one of the things I try to show in my book is that since so much of our politics is now irrational, that psychoanalysis is often kind of the attempt to be a kind of a science of the irrational and to look at the logic behind irrationality. And so one of the great questions is, you know, why do the working class identify with and support someone like Donald Trump, a billionaire? And Thomas Frank has written a lot about this, but I don't think he can fully explain it because he doesn't have a psychoanalytic theory. So one of the things that I main ideas I bring up is this idea that if you talk to a lot of very wealthy people, they represent themselves as victims. They're victims of taxes, victims of government regulation, victims of liberal culture, victims of political correctness, and Trump really kind of embodies that. And one way that the working class identify with someone like Trump is through the shared victimhood. And even though, you know, a lot of working class have a lot of reasons to feel persecuted or victimized, there is this kind of bonding between the wealthy and the poor over this sense that the liberals have taken over the world, that political correctness oppresses them, that the true source of power in our society is not the powerful businesses or wealthy people like Trump, but the real, according to this conservative logic, the real source of authority are the elite liberals who make everyone feel bad for their sexist and racist feelings and aggression. And so I try to explain how psychoanalysis offers this idea of how people might actually enjoy being victims, and that from the level of the unconscious, you have this combination of fact and fiction and pleasure and pain. And so one of Freud's controversial ideas is that people fantasize about being victims. And the risk of this theory is it can blame victims and it can ignore real victimhood. But I think it's very important to
Which was one of the critiques of Freud, of course, is particularly important to early feminism.
Right. But I still think it's very important to show how this powerful identity of being a victim and people bonding over victimhood really drives a lot of our politics. For instance, after 9/11, the United States, the most powerful world country in the world, positions itself as the victim. And since the victim is always morally right and you can't criticize the victim's aggression is always justified, and there's no ability to criticize the victim. And I think in Trump we see this idea of, like, he's always the victim of, like, the politics. He just came out with a tweet against Meryl Streep, you know, like, he's so defensive and he always represents himself as a victim, and then he lashes out and feels totally justified to lash out at other people. And this is part of the bulliness of him.
You also describe another dynamic, though, that may be important in describing the unconscious forces in play, that it's not only a victim state of being able to make claims and accusations and a sense of entitlement attached to it, but also to be able to project power. And there's a kind of politics of revenge because he's also an incredible bully and projects power and has an authoritarian style that many people have talked about. Is there something important about this contradiction between the helplessness of the victim who's overtaken by something more powerful and the projection of power that is embodied in an authoritarian leader such as Trump, and maybe his appeal, particularly for working class or lower middle class white men?
Well, I think, you know, one of the important things is when Trump said he could shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue and his supporters wouldn't care, I think I turned to Freud's theory of hypnosis and also groups like churches and armies, and show how this kind of submission to the authority and to the idealized authority is often the solution. People feel victimized. They feel like they've lost social power. In many cases, they have lost social power. So they turn to a strong man, you know, a leader, a demagogue, to basically fix all their problems. So Trump just says he's going to fix everything. He's going to make deals. He kind of ignores the whole idea that we have a government, that we have a democratic process. And it's this kind of theory of the great man who's going to save all of us, and that people who feel victimized or helpless then turn to this leader and then uncritically support the leader because the leader is supposed to, you know, make everything okay. And once again, there's this unconscious process We identify with this leader, and we suspend our own like critical faculties, and it becomes this kind of group hysteria.
Now, you've also taken up a line of critique of the Clinton campaign and contemporary forms of liberalism, and here you also have some of these group dynamics and an important principle of social justice movements throughout history is the importance of the group, the solidarity and power of the group, that there are many places you can't get to alone, that you depend on others and leaders who embody your ideals. How do you distinguish between that form of progressive group psychology, if you might call it that, and these more regressive forms of submitting to the powerful father out of the fantasy of that the powerful father can identify enough with your suffering to care about it, but redeem you and deliver you from it in some magical way?
So I discuss in one chapter the populism of the left versus the populism of the right. And as you're saying, you know, every social movement needs some type of group solidarity. But the question is, how irrational is that solidarity? How much of it is, and how much self-criticism and criticism by others is allowed? And one of the things that I talk about in relationship to the left, especially to the liberal left, and Clinton in particular, is this notion that Frank also talks about, meritocratic narcissism. So this idea that people are so invested in the professional elite and of seeing themselves as doing good and being good, that they're not able to deal with any criticism of their actions or the effect of their actions. So I think a big problem with the liberal left is this, you know, abandonment of the working class, abandonment of unions, but also this kind of fear of any real radical alternative, and also the inability to look at the harm done by a lot of their policies. And so part of this is, I call narcissism, in the sense like they have an overinvestment in seeing themselves as good and a fear of any type of criticism that would make them feel bad. And I think that this is run throughout American liberal policy, where they often embark in these well-intentioned ideas like aid to the third world, but often those aid policies have very negative effects. But because they don't want to look at those negative effects, they just keep on doing them.
Now, you're speaking not only from an armchair psychoanalytic perspective, but working on campuses and on the streets of union politics on campuses in California. Can you say a bit about your work as the union president representing non-tenured faculty and librarians in California, and how these this kind of narcissism you're describing as perhaps a not an individual pathology, but a kind of current or binding affect to groups, you might say, something that holds people together but not in helpful ways, how you see that played out on college campuses?
So a big thing is right now the vast majority of faculty now do not have tenure or the possibility of tenure. They're often hired at the last minute. They often don't have academic freedom or any type of shared governance. And these are supposed to be the ideals of the liberal university and of the liberal professors and liberal faculty. And so these institutions have become very exploitive and very illiberal, you might say. And yet people still see the university as this ideal place often. And a lot of the faculty are so invested in seeing themselves as good that they don't really address the very negative things that are happening at their own institutions.
You're talking about tenured faculty who have a degree of there's still a fairly aristocratic life in some areas and tremendous security, and yet depends massively on exploited labor.
Right. So this is once again a tricky thing, because I mean the right attacks like all elites and all, you know, experts as liberal, but there is a kernel of truth in what they're talking about, in the sense that there can be this kind of bubble and this kind of what Frank calls this narcissism of the group, where basically they're so invested in seeing themselves as good and believing that their well-intentioned actions are all good, that they can't look at the problems that they cause, and they also have a very hard time dealing with people who are not within their professional group. And so these divisions that occur, a lot of people feel that the Democratic Party has moved from representing the working class and the majority of workers to representing kind of the elite, especially the educational elite and the professional managerial elite. And so there's no one there really representing the working class. And so that opens up the door for the conservatives and someone like Trump to say, like, he's representing the working class. Because really, in many ways, the liberals have given up on focusing on liberal class policies. And like one little example, or big example, is the Affordable Care Act, which has many good things in the sense that it did help to insure a lot of people, but it really was a policy made by the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank, first instituted by a Republican governor, Mitt Romney. And it, in many ways, it is a way of creating just more customers for private insurance companies. And so, and the problems that this policy is generating, it's very hard for the liberal class to deal with, because they want to see their policies as all good and well-intentioned, and they don't want to deal with the criticism.
But this is also very difficult politically, and we're coming into an era where we really need to reflect on these questions. As you point out in many ways in your book, it's not enough to unify around an anti-Trump stance, not my president, love Trump's hate, and all of that. But there's a real potential in the upcoming period to focus on Trump as the big bad other, as psychoanalysts would call it, and to unify against that. But at the same time, as you see so much dismantling of social welfare and the public sector, how do you defend these fraying services and institutions at the same time you talk about their limits?
So what I think might happen, I mean, the working class, and it's very hard to define exactly what that is, but have invested a lot in Trump, and I think Trump is going to completely betray them. And so I think that if the left presents an alternative, like Bernie Sanders in many ways did, I have some criticisms of Sanders, but generally he did appeal to the working class. He did offer an alternative. And that's been missing a lot from the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party really, you know, tried to undermine him as much as they could. The official Democratic National Committee spent a lot of money and time undermining Sanders, because this is a case of the liberals undermining the alternative left. So I think at the same time that we criticize Trump and hold him accountable, we have to really push for an alternative. And we have to, you know, come together, different groups, and realize the final chapter of my book is that a lot of our problems are global in nature, and the national solution is not going to work. Like, you can't tax the wealthy, because the wealthy just move their money all over the world, and you can't control labor regulations, because people just move jobs all over the world, and you can't control environmental protections, because people will just move factories to other countries that don't have the same environmental laws. So we have to, like, move into this new stage where we have global politics and a push for some type of global regulation and global governance. And so I think we're living in an outmoded kind of political discourse. And even someone like Sanders didn't really understand the full or have a policy about globalization. And so instead, a lot of his policies can be read as kind of national or even nationalistic. And so we have to, instead of appealing to the working class by saying, oh, we're going to save your jobs by putting up protections and having tariffs and having a tariff war, we have to find kind of a global economic model and global economic justice, and we have to bring people together on that.
And we'll continue to have you on the show as we bring people together around these the whole concept of what global social justice movement looks like. Well, thank you so much, Bob Samuels, for being with us today. Your book is fantastic, and it'll be there'll be more on it on our website when it's posted later this week. I'm talking with Robert Samuels, author of Psychoanalyzing the Left and Right After Donald Trump, Conservatism, Liberalism, and Neoliberal Populisms. Thanks so much, Bob, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And thank you, Jan. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on your community-sponsored radio station, KBOO. I'm Clayton Margridge. Well, we heard earlier from Joe Clement channeling Peter Fraser about the way to end wage slavery, a way to end wage slavery that could be accomplished starting within the framework of capitalism. But there's another way we might imagine the coming of a better world. The following is a summary review written near the end of the 21st century, recalling revolutionary events that had recently occurred. Riding a wave of revulsion against the disasters of the Trump years, a new movement took the reins of state power with vast popular support. Its first action was to issue the following declaration with three articles. Article 1. All forms of money are hereby abolished. Coins and paper money are now no more than material objects that may serve as bookmarks or jewelry or relics, but they no longer have the power to command labor and the products of labor. They are no longer legal tender. The same is true of money in all forms. All institutions that function as repositories, exchanges, and creators of money, including banks, insurance companies, stock exchanges, brokers, and investment companies, will cease to exist. Article 2. Everyone who is now engaged in providing food, housing, clothing, education, child and elder care, medical services, artistic production, transportation, communication systems, including the internet, and scientific research, are encouraged to continue their work in collaboration with their co-workers and with the people they serve. Those who worked in the money business are invited to find other satisfying and useful work. Article 3 had two sections. Section 1. People in law enforcement should remain in place for now to respond to crimes of violence against persons and to enforce traffic laws. As property crime diminishes, there will be less need for police, prosecutors, courts, and prisons, thus freeing many who now work in those fields to find other things to do. We ask that people who now work in law enforcement, judges, prosecutors, prison administrators, and guards, join with psychologists and social workers to transform these institutions of punishment into programs aimed at helping those who have harmed others to live better with others. Section 2. All military bases outside our borders will be closed, and personnel and equipment returned to the U.S. The military will function only to protect the nation from external attack, a need we expect to diminish as our relations with other nations and peoples are renegotiated on principles independent of money. People no longer needed in the armed services will be free to find other work to do. Now, this declaration did not drop on us out of the blue. The way had been prepared by a decade of education and discussion leading up to this revolutionary moment. Discussions revolved around two questions. First, could we count on people to do what needs to be done without the threat of poverty and the reward of personal wealth? People were less inclined to believe dogmatic claims about the incorrigible greediness of human nature when the question was posed as a thought experiment. Suppose there was no such thing as money. How, then, would we live? This question liberated the imagination as people began to think in new ways about how they would really like to be spending their lives and to be connected to each other. It dawned on them that the most humanly valuable work is done primarily out of love for the work or from a desire to support and enrich the lives of others, or both. As the discussions went on in homes, schools, churches, coffee shops and taverns, and in the press and social media, the enthusiasm for a cooperative society grew quickly. People began to feel invested in the project of bringing it about. The second question in the run-up to the new order set out in the Declaration was the question of political power or the role of the state. Needless to say, the removal of the financial coercion built into capitalism was not intended to be replaced with other sorts of coercion. We were aiming at a free society based on an ethic of cooperation. Yet even voluntary cooperation has to be organized. For example, people need information about where their interests and talents are wanted and needed. A network of web designers set to work creating and testing in advance a website for posting and signing up for opportunities to work and to be trained in new skills. It should not be supposed that the Declaration was issued and implemented as the result only of an election. No normal political procedure under the old Constitution would permit the abolition of money and thereby the end of the rule of capital. The revolution arose from the people's emerging consensus that they could and would live and work cooperatively without economic or state coercion. This meant that no significant block of people would stand in the way of this declaration. And so it was. The police and military forces that had served to protect the power of capital dissipated as soldiers and cops were happy to give up the job of making people respect the old authorities of money and the state. In the old world, most of us were faced throughout our lives with the problem of how to earn our living, and the way we solved or failed to solve that problem usually determined the overall quality of our lives. Making a living was a problem that faced us primarily as individuals and sometimes as families, but never as communities or as a society. With the abolition of money, we are confronted, together with the problem of how we shall live, working cooperatively to maintain ourselves and to expand our capacities and enjoyment. We have replaced the individual and competitive pursuit of money with the collective and cooperative pursuit of a flourishing community life in which each of us can realize our fullest possible development. That's the end of this historical sketch from the future. I offer it only as one contribution to what I hope will be a growing project of expanding the ability of the left, and indeed all of us, to imagine concretely and vividly a world in which we no longer have to build our lives around what financial necessity requires of us, but around what we love. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart.
And we have Nina Simone to thank for that heartfelt statement of what this whole show has been about, from the desires of intersex people like Carrie Cantrell to be free of the surgical and moral control of their bodies, to the desire of every one of us to live lives of our own without the shackles of jobs designed to make rich people even richer. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer is Patsy Kullberg. Join us again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground point of view. Today's show will be posted on the KBOO website in a day or two. That's kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Stay tuned now to KBOO for Chris Andre was not able to make it in this morning because of the road conditions. So instead, we will be hearing some material from the Union Edge Radio. And then at 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein welcomes the author of The Grid, The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future. At 11, Health Watch discusses the hidden cause behind a wide array of health problems with the author of The Thyroid Problem. And at 11:30, it's Between the Lines, a weekly radio news magazine. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one easily by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Inner Boy Workshop at the Portland Underground.